readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and if you're like me, you're slightly apprehensive about September being just ahead. Its arrival signals the end of summer and the beginning of a fuller workload, even if you don't have to deal with kids heading back to school. As your literary guide, I'm here to offer some respite. Let's indulge in a bit of fantasy with an escape into a world of adult fairy tales. Never fear, it's not just fluff and nonsense. Often these tales have a lesson to share in a deep, memorable way. So journey with me as we turn to page one of the book report. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. High in his attic bedroom, 12-year-old David mourns the loss of his mother. Angry and alone, he has only the books on his shelf for company. But those books have begun to whisper to him in the darkness, and he takes refuge in the myths and fairy tales his mother had loved. For him, the real world and the fantasy world have begun to meld, and the crooked man has come with his mocking smile and his enigmatic words, "Welcome, Your Majesty. All hail the new king." With echoes of Gregory Maguire and C.S. Lewis, John Connolly's The Book of Lost Things introduces us to a cast of not-quite-familiar characters, like the seven socialist dwarfs who poison an uninvited princess and try to peg the crime on her stepmother, or the Loops, the evil human-canine hybrids spawned long ago by the union of a wolf and a seductive girl in a red cloak. As war rages across Europe, David is propelled into a land that is both a construct of his imagination and frighteningly real. Stephen Crossley narrates.
Before she became ill, David's mother would often tell him that stories were alive. They weren't alive in the way that people were alive, or even dogs or cats. People were alive whether you chose to notice them or not, while dogs tended to make you notice them if they decided that you weren't paying them enough attention. Cats, meanwhile, were very good at pretending people didn't exist at all when it suited them. But that was another matter entirely. Stories were different, though. They came alive in the telling. Without a human voice to read them aloud, or a pair of wide eyes following them by flashlight beneath a blanket, they had no real existence in our world. They were like seeds in the beak of a bird, waiting to fall to earth, or the notes of a song laid out on a sheet, yearning for an instrument to bring their music into being. They lay dormant, hoping for the chance to emerge. Once someone started to read them, they could begin to change. They could take root in the imagination and transform the reader. Stories wanted to be read, David's mother would whisper. They needed it. It was the reason they forced themselves from their world into ours. They wanted us to give them life. These were the things that his mother told David before the illness took her. She would often have a book in her hand as she spoke, and she would run her fingertips lovingly across the cover, just as she would sometimes touch them to David's face, or to his father's, when he said or did something that reminded her of how much he cared for him. The sound of his mother's voice was like a song to David, one that was constantly revealing new improvisations or previously unheard subtleties. As he grew older and music became more important to him, although never quite as important as books, he thought of his mother's voice less as a song and more as a kind of symphony, capable of infinite variations on familiar themes and melodies that changed according to her moods and whims. As the years went by, the reading of a book became a more solitary experience for David, until his mother's illness returned them both to his early childhood, but with the roles reversed. Nevertheless, before she grew sick, he would often step quietly into the room in which his mother was reading, acknowledging her with a smile, always returned, before taking a seat close by and immersing himself in his own book, so that, although both were lost in their own individual worlds, they shared the same space and time. And David could tell by looking at her face as she read whether or not the story contained in the book was living inside her and she in it, and he would recall again all that she had told him about stories and tales and the power that they wield over us, and that we in turn wield over them. David would always remember the day his mother died. He was in school, learning or not learning how to scan a poem, his mind filled with dactyls and pentameters, the names like those of strange dinosaurs inhabiting a lost prehistoric landscape. The headmaster opened the classroom door and approached the English master, Mr. Benjamin, or Big Ben as he was known to his pupils because of his size and his habit of withdrawing his old pocket watch from the folds of his waistcoat and announcing in deep, mournful tones the slow passage of time to his unruly students. The headmaster whispered something to Mr. Benjamin, and Mr. Benjamin nodded solemnly.
That was The Book of Lost Things by John Connolly. Daniel Wallace is the author of 5 novels. His first, Big Fish, was made into a movie by Tim Burton in 2003, and a musical version is coming to Broadway. Daniel is the J. Ross MacDonald Distinguished Professor of English at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he teaches and directs the Creative Writing Program. We'll speak with him today about his new book, The Kings and Queens of Rome. Welcome, Daniel. Thanks for stopping by the Book Report.
My pleasure.
Reviewers have called The Kings and Queens of Rome an adult fairy tale. Do you concur?
It's always helpful to hear what other people have to say about the book after I've written it, because while I'm writing it, I have no idea what it is. But a fairy tale is one way to look at it. Fable, I am very interested in and influenced by myth, and so I think it lives somewhere in between those worlds.
Tell us about the story by introducing Rachel and Helen McAllister.
Okay. Rachel and Helen McAllister are sisters who live together in a very large house, just the two of them now, since their parents have died. Helen is the older sister. She's incredibly unattractive and bitter about that. And Rachel is her younger sister, who's blind but quite beautiful. And one day, as things would have it, Helen tells Rachel a story, begins telling her a story, and the thrust of it is that she changes faces with her little sister. She tells her sister that she's the ugly one, and that that Helen is actually the beautiful one, and things spiral from there, somewhat out of control, in a controlled way, I would say.
Yeah, and there's this parallel backstory of Elijah McAllister and Ming Kai. Fill us in about that.
Yeah. 100 years before the present story takes place, the town of Rome, R-O-A-M, where they live, was founded by Elijah McAllister, who is the kind of the modeled on the robber barons of the past, and incredibly ambitious to make his mark in the world, and he kidnaps a man in China named Ming Kai, who is has the secret of making this wonderful silk, and Elijah sees in him his key to fortune and fame, and kidnaps him and brings him back to America, where they establish this town in the middle of nowhere, where they've discovered this grove of mulberry trees.
Right, and yet they have this really, very big love-hate thing going on.
Yeah, he's described as his hostage and best friend, and this it's interesting to me the way different people live in the world and what they're capable of. Ming Kai is not and a particularly ambitious man, but being kidnapped by Elijah brings him into a world that he never would have ever been to on his own. It's actually a life of adventure, which part of him appreciates and part of him despises him for. His life is a mixed blessing or a mixed curse, depending on how you look at it.
Now, ghosts populate your book, so have you ever met any?
Well, let me get them out of the room right now. I have not met any ghosts myself, but I believe in them in as much as the past and people that have been in your life throughout it and are gone now are ghostly. They hang around. While I was writing this book, in fact, and if you can look at the front of the book at the dedication. It's dedicated to four people who all died as I was writing this book. And in fact, in the early drafts of this book, and believe me, there are a number of drafts, there were no ghosts. And as these very, very dear people started to die, they influenced the narrative in the way that you see it now.
Hmm. And dogs play an important role in the story. Why is that?
Well, part of it is just me. I love dogs. I think dogs are important. I think I tell my students, if you're having trouble with the story, put a dog in it. It's going to be better. I also think that dogs are important to us as a race. You know, I think that they helped. We domesticated a dog, but they helped domesticate us. And I feel strongly that they're tied to who we are as people. They do what looks like magic things in the book, but I don't really see it that way. I see them as dogs being dogs, and dogs do magic things all the time, in my world anyway.
I agree. Since you've identified this as a fairy tale, is there a message or a parable you want readers to take away from it?
When I'm writing a book, my goal is to have a reader live in it and not want to leave it, and to turn the page just eager to find out what happens next. And so that's always my main goal. And whatever, never do I write toward a lesson or a moral. I think that, however, in reading this book, that you can come away with it, you know, as you investigate the themes that it delves into. That love and forgiveness are wonderful things. Now, that's such a, I mean, that sounds so flat and so uninspired, and it's kind of the thing that falls out of the book and out of the story. But it, you know, it's not really what my point is in writing this book or writing any book.
And I'm not going to give anything away, but the ending is so very, very poignant.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, it took me years. this book took me longer to write than any other book I've written, and part of the problem was that I couldn't find the ending, and I kept writing these endings, which I hoped were right, but weren't. And just over the course of time, and probably just by eliminating every other possible ending, I came up with the one that we have now, and I believe that it works, and I do think it works, because it is the only possible ending.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. So what's next for you?
Well, I'm doing a lot of different things. I'm working on another novel and some short stories. I'm writing screenplays, and it's summer vacation, and so I'm keeping myself busy.
All right, and perhaps is one of those activities alligator wrestler? You want to fill us in on that?
You know, it's so funny the way these things happen. When we were making the website, my the guy who was building it for me, he put that in just as a joke, and meaning that we would go back and change it later. We never went back in and changed it. So I'm just creating this myth of myself, which I hope will live beyond my own span.
I really enjoyed the book, and I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of The Kings and Queens of Rome, narrated by Angela Brazil.
Rachel McAllister and her sister, Helen, lived together in the home they grew up in. And as far as anyone could tell, Rachel and Helen included, this is where they would die as well. Though they were both quite young, Helen was 25 years old and Rachel was only 18, their path seemed clear and predictable, each girl so closely bound to the other that to imagine even a day apart was a pointless foray into fantasy. You might as well imagine building a cabin on a cloud. They lived in a town called Rome, a town founded 100 years ago by their great-grandfather, Elijah McAllister, and his Chinese friend and hostage, Ming Kai, where they hoped to make the finest silk the world had ever known. Bordered by a great mountain on one side and a bottomless ravine on the other, and shadowed by dark green forests full of bears and wild dogs, the town, even after a century's existence, felt like the abandoned capital of an ancient civilization, still a wonder to behold out here in the middle of nowhere, but worn down, broken, nearly empty. One day the vegetable world would reclaim it, and all the evidence of every man and woman who had called it home, and those who still lived there, 227 people at last count, though the number grew smaller by the day, could only serve as witnesses. The dead outnumbered the living tenfold now. There were so many dead, their spirits could no longer be contained in the darkness, and, like deer, their population had spilled over into parts of the town reserved for the living. Sometimes they formed a cool shaft of stray light that leaked into dark rooms, beneath closet doors, into alleyways. There was nowhere you could go in Rome without feeling them, but only rarely would they actually allow themselves to be seen.
That was The Kings and Queens of Rome by Daniel Wallace.
Readers, I've just finished listening to Neil Gaiman's Ocean at the End of the Lane, narrated by Neil, and I was mesmerized. Seems I'm in very good company, as the book is making a strong showing in the Times bestseller list. The story is set in Sussex, England. A middle-aged man returns to his childhood home to attend a funeral. He's drawn to the farm at the end of the road, where, when he was 7, he encountered a most remarkable girl, Letty Hemstock. He hasn't thought of Letty in decades, and yet, sitting by the pond, the unremembered past comes flooding back. 40 years earlier, a man committed suicide in a stolen car at this farm at the end of the road. Like a fuse on a firework, his death set off an unimaginable chain of events. The darkness was unleashed, and Letty, magical, comforting, wise beyond her years, protects the boy from darkness, inside and out.
Nobody came to my 7th birthday party. There was a table laid with jellies and trifles with a party hat beside each place and a birthday cake with 7 candles on it in the center of the table. The cake had a book drawn on it in icing. My mother, who had organized the party, told me that the lady at the bakery said that they had never put a book on a birthday cake before and that mostly for boys it was footballs or spaceships. I was their first book. When it became obvious that nobody was coming, my mother lit the 7 candles on the cake and I blew them out. I ate a slice of the cake, as did my little sister and one of her friends, both of them attending the party as observers, not participants, before they fled, giggling, to the garden. Party games had been prepared by my mother, but because nobody was there, not even my sister. None of the party games were played, and I unwrapped the newspaper around the Pass the Parcel gift myself, revealing a blue plastic Batman figure. I was sad that nobody had come to my party, but happy that I had a Batman figure, and there was a birthday present waiting to be read, a boxed set of the Narnia books, which I took upstairs. I lay on the bed and lost myself in the stories. I liked that. Books were safer than other people anyway. My parents had also given me a Best of Gilbert and Sullivan LP to add to the two that I already had. I'd loved Gilbert and Sullivan since I was three, when my father's youngest sister, my aunt, took me to see Iolanthe, a play filled with lords and fairies. I found the existence and nature of the fairies easier to understand than that of the lords. My aunt had died soon after, of pneumonia, in the hospital. That evening, my father arrived home from work, and he brought a cardboard box with him. In the cardboard box was a soft-haired black kitten of uncertain gender, whom I immediately named Fluffy, and which I loved utterly and wholeheartedly. Fluffy slept on my bed at night. I talked to it sometimes when my little sister was not around, half expecting it to answer in a human tongue. It never did. I did not mind. The kitten was affectionate and interested and a good companion for someone whose seventh birthday party had consisted of a table with iced biscuits and a blancmange and cake and 15 empty folding chairs. I do not remember ever asking any of the other children in my class at school why they had not come to my party. I did not need to ask them. They were not my friends, after all. They were just the people I went to school with. I made friends slowly when I made them. I had books, and now I had my kitten. We would be like Dick Whittington and his cat, I knew, or if Fluffy proved particularly intelligent, we would be the Miller's Son and Puss in Boots. The kitten slept on my pillow, and it even waited for me to come home from school sitting on the driveway in front of my house by the fence until a month later it was run over by the taxi that brought the opal miner to stay at my house. I was not there when it happened. I got home from school that day and my kitten was not waiting to meet me. In the kitchen was a tall, rangy man with tanned skin and a checked shirt. He was drinking coffee at the kitchen table. I could smell it. In those days, all coffee was instant coffee, a bitter dark brown powder that came out of a jar. "I'm afraid I had a little accident arriving here," he told me cheerfully, "but not to worry." His accent was clipped, unfamiliar. It was the first South African accent I had heard. He, too, had a cardboard box on the table in front of him. "The black kitten, was he yours?" he asked. "It's called Fluffy," I said. "Yeah, like I said, accident coming here. Not to worry. Disposed of the corpse. Don't have to trouble yourself. Dealt with the matter. Open the box." "What?" He pointed to the box. "Open it," he said. The opal miner was a tall man. He wore jeans and checked shirts every time I saw him, except the last. He had a thick chain of pale gold around his neck. That was gone the last time I saw him, too.
We've just heard The Ocean at the End of the Lane by Neil Gaiman. Sci-fi boldly goes to universes that captivate us with their imaginings. Here's a title from Orson Scott Card, an author who's been in the news quite a bit lately. There's great anticipation about the film based on his blockbuster series, Ender's Game. It's due out in November. And there's quite a to-do centered around a boycott of the movie, called by a group who wants to publicize Card's opposition to same-sex marriage. But today, let's preview one of his recent tales, written with Aaron Johnston, Earth Unaware. The mining ship El Cavador is far out from Earth, in a belt beyond Pluto. Other mining ships are few and far between. So when El Cavador's telescopes pick up a fast-moving object coming in system, it's hard to know what to make of it. But its arrival is one of the most important events that's happened to the human race in a million years. The first formic war is about to begin. Readers, here's a heads up on this title, though. Some reviews call this story unfinished and say it ends abruptly without fulfilling the listener's expectations. Is this book a setup for the next book to come? Yes. But most feel it's a story that can stand alone. An ensemble cast narrates.
Dogging from endogamy, marrying inside the clan, inbreeding. The word was like a slap. Talking? But I would never in a million years marry Alejandra. How could you even suggest that we would do such a thing? It was vile to even think it. To the better families, it was on the wrong side of the incest taboo. Concepcion said, "You and Alejandra have been the closest of friends since your nursery years, Victor. Inseparable. I've watched you. We've all watched you. In large gatherings, you always seek each other out. You talk to each other constantly. Sometimes you don't even need to talk. It's as if you know precisely what the other is thinking, and you need share only a passing glance between you to communicate it all. She's my friend. You're going to exile her because we communicate well with each other? Your friendship isn't unique, Victor. I know of several dozen such friendships on this ship, and they are all between a husband and his wife. You're sending Alejandra away on the basis that she and I have a romantic relationship when we don't. It's an innocent relationship, Victor. Everyone knows that. Everyone? Who do you mean exactly? Has there been a family meeting about us? Only a council. I would never make this decision on my own, Victor. Not much of a relief. The council consisted of all the adults over 40. So my parents agree to this? And Alejandra's parents as well. This was a difficult decision for all of us, Victor. But it was unanimous. Victor pictured the scene. All of the adults gathered together, aunts and uncles and grandparents, people he knew and loved and respected, people whose opinion he valued, people who had always looked upon him fondly and whose respect he had always hoped to maintain. All of them had sat together and discussed him and Honda, discussed a sex life that Victor didn't even have. It was revolting. And mother and father had been there. How embarrassing for them. How could Victor ever face these people again? They would never be able to look at him without thinking of that meeting, without remembering the accusation and shame. No one is suggesting that you two have done anything improper, Victor. That's why we're acting now, before your feelings further blossom and you realize you're in love. Another slap. Love? I know this is difficult, Victor. Difficult? No, unfair would be a better word. Completely unfair and unfounded, not to mention humiliating. They were sending away his closest friend. Perhaps his only true friend, all because they thought something would happen between them? As if he and Honda were animals in heat driven by unbridled carnal impulses. Was it too much to imagine that a teenage boy and a teenage girl could simply be friends? Did adults think so little of adolescence that they assumed that any relationship between 16 and 17-year-olds of the opposite sex had to be motivated by sex? It was infuriating and insulting. Here he was making an adult-sized contribution in the trade with the Italians, bringing in the largest share of income for the family, and they didn't think him mature enough to act properly with his second cousin. Honda wasn't in love with him, and he wasn't in love with her. Why would anyone think otherwise? What had initiated this? Had someone on the council seen something between them and misinterpreted it as a sign of love? And then Victor remembered. There was that time when Honda had looked at him strangely, and he had dismissed it as pure imagination. And she had touched his arm a little longer than normal once. It wasn't sexual at all, but he had liked the physical contact between them. That connection hadn't repulsed him. He had enjoyed it. They were right, he realized. He hadn't seen it, and they had. He really was on the brink of falling in love with Honda. And she had fallen in love with him. Or at least her feelings were moving in that direction.
We've listened to a sampling of Earth Unaware by Orson Scott Card and Aaron Johnston. Here's a thriller that weaves in the paranormal. It's a genre not usually visited by the Book Report, but the reviews on this series make it worth a look. The Night is Alive, Crew of Hunters, Book 10, by Heather Graham, takes place in Savannah, a city of beauty, history, and hauntings. One of the most haunted places in Savannah is a tavern called the Dragon Slayer, built in the 1750s. The current owner, Gus Anderson, is a descendant of the original innkeeper and his pirate brother, Blue. Gus summons his granddaughter, Abigail, home from Virginia, where she's studying at the FBI Academy. When she arrives, she's devastated to find her grandfather dead, murdered. But Abby soon learns Gus is not the only one to meet a brutal end. There are other victims. Then, Captain Blue Anderson starts making ghostly appearances, and the FBI's paranormal investigation unit, the Crew of Hunters, is sent in with Agent Malachi Gordon. Abby and Malachi meet, and the sparks begin to fly, sparks of attraction and discord. But as the death toll rises, they must learn to trust each other and work together to solve the mystery. Luke Daniels narrates.
If she'd been able to move, she would have. She would have screamed and gone running back to her room to hide under the bed. But she couldn't move. She could hardly breathe, much less scream. He smiled again, tipped his tricorn hat, glanced outside one more time, and then slowly disappeared. As he did, she heard the door open. Her eyes darted to it with fear. It was her grandparents coming back into the building. But it had to be about 4 in the morning, and they didn't go out at 4 a.m. From the stairway window, she hadn't managed to move yet, she realized there were flashing lights in the parking lot. Flashing lights? The kind police cars had.
"Not to worry. They got 'em, Brenda, my love,"
Gus told her grandmother.
"Yes, but, oh, Gus, that horrible man might have gotten in."
Her grandmother sounded worried. She was such a wonderful grandmother, different from most, perhaps. She wasn't much of a cookie baker. But she came to all of Abby's school events. She loved to dress up. She read stories and acted out all the characters. She was slim and energetic, too. She loved a long bike ride.
"Hey, so what? He would have stolen what little cash we have in the register, but he didn't get in. We woke up, we called the police. All is good,"
Gus said. He looked up then, just as Blue had done, but of course, she couldn't really have seen Blue. That would have been seeing a ghost.
"Hey, Munchkin, what are you doing up?"
Gus called to her. She willed her frozen lungs to function.
I woke up,"
she said. Her voice sounded funny when she forced herself to move.
I just woke up, and I couldn't find you."
"It's okay now, Abby. Everything's okay. You can go back to sleep,"
Gus told her.
"What happened?"
she asked. Her grandmother turned to her grandfather, and Gus answered.
"A thief trying to break in, baby. But the police got him. We're fine."
"Back to bed, child,"
her grandmother said. She smiled to lighten the sternness of her words.
"It's late, or early, whichever. Time for young'uns to be asleep. What would your parents say about the way we keep you up?"
"Mom and Dad wouldn't mind. Mom always says you're the best. She said that if you and Gus weren't so wonderful, she'd never be able to travel with Dad as much as she does. Not many kids are so lucky. I get to stay with you."
Her father worked for a major tech company and traveled frequently. She had a room at the tavern with almost as much stuff in it as her room in the house on Chippewa Square.
"Be that as it may,"
her grandmother began,
"I want you back in your bed. It's a school night."
Abby gave her grandfather a wide-eyed look. He was an easier mark than her grandmother. She couldn't possibly go back to bed. Alone. Not yet.
"Come on down. We'll have a cup of tea and then we'll go back to bed. How's that?"
She managed to nod and to come running the rest of the way down the stairs.
Abigail Anderson, Brenda said sternly. I told you not to run around barefoot. Glasses do break, my darling, and even when we clean up, you can't be sure we get all the little slivers.
Leave her be right now, Brenda,
Gus suggested. Brenda wagged a finger at her.
Tonight, just tonight, you follow the tavern rules. My rules, young lady, or you don't stay here anymore.
Yes, ma'am,
Abby said. Brenda spun on Gus.
And you! Don't go putting a shot of whiskey in her tea to calm her down, do you hear me? She's barely 10.
Oh, Brenda, it's what our parents did for us.
And nowadays it's considered child abuse. You two behave. I'm going back up.
She caught Abby's chin and gave her a kiss on the cheek before she went up the winding staircase. Gus winked at Abby.
Come into the kitchen, he said. We'll brew some tea.
We've just heard The Night is Alive by Heather Graham. Jason Ho's The Darwin Elevator is a pulse-pounding debut set in mid-23rd century Darwin, Australia, the last human city on Earth. The world has succumbed to an alien plague, with most of the population transformed into mindless, savage creatures. The planet's refugees flock to Darwin, where a space elevator, created by the architects of this apocalypse, the Builders, emits a plague-suppressing aura. Skylar Lucan has a rare immunity to the plague. Backed by an international crew of fellow immunes, he leads missions into the dangerous wasteland beyond the aura's edge to find the resources Darwin needs to stave off collapse. But when the elevator starts to malfunction, Skylar is tapped, along with scientist Dr. Tanya Sharma, to save the ragged remnants of humanity. Book Report favorite Simon Vance narrates.
Angus turned in the pilot's seat, trying to see Skylar over his shoulder and failing. A few seconds passed before the kid flashed a half-hearted A-OK. The Melville tilted forward and began to descend. Skylar leaned to his left and looked down, watching mountainous clouds rise toward them. Lightning danced beneath the purple morass, which grew and grew until finally the aircraft slipped into the thick haze. A ghostly fog roiled around the cockpit window for less than 10 seconds, and then they were through. Once below the storm, monsoon rain pelted the cockpit window and hammered against the fuselage. Another minute went by before they passed under the storm. Over Darwin itself, the sky was clear. Such a rare thing in wet season. A nice welcome to their return.
Aura's edge, Angus said. In 10, 9,
Skylar closed his eyes. Some small part of him wanted to feel it, wanted to know the elevator's strange aura on a physical level. The invisible field emanated roughly 9 kilometers out from the space elevator before abruptly ending. It protected those within from the alien disease that had laid waste to the rest of the planet. How or why the aura did this was as much a mystery as the elevator itself.
5, 4...
The shifting, rippling effect ended in a zone coined Aura's Edge, a no-man's land where the protection faded. Skylar leaned his head back against the co-pilot's seat. He would feel nothing. He never did. Nor did the rest of the crew. The disease had no effect on them. They were immune. An inescapable fact. A blessing and curse. A trait few others shared. Very few.
3.
Though immunity allowed him to leave the city at will, there remained that small part of him that wanted to be normal. To be trapped, like all the rest of them. He didn't want to be special, or sought after. Truth be told, he'd rather be back in the Netherlands, flying mundane patrols for the Air Force, living a good life. But that was a long time ago, in a different world.
2, 1, mark.
The aircraft bucked. Not much, but Skylar felt it.
Damn fine timing for a spell of turbulence, he thought. An embarrassed laugh escaped his lips.
Below, out the window, trash fires dotted the city's edge. Small crowds huddled around the flames for protection more than warmth. The worst off lived here, so far out from the elevator, so close to the clear. Skylar thought it must be like living on the edge of a cliff.
Weird. Did you feel that bounce? Angus asked. Then, ah. Look at this. Skylar glanced up. The kid's voice had shifted from wonder to fear. Something had changed ahead of them. Skylar couldn't decide what. Where'd the climbers go? Angus asked. The lights on the cord were gone. What in the world? The wireless crackled.
Marvel, this is Nightlift Control, a panicked voice said over a hiss of static. What the hell did you do?
Skylar's throat went dry. He could only stare at the thin strip of sky where the climbers had been.
Melville! Answer will be shut down.
Angus, Skylar said, ignoring the radio. Hover here. The kid nodded and tilted the aircraft back, switching to vertical thrust.
Think, think, Skylar whispered to himself.
He leaned forward in his seat as if a few extra centimeters would give him a better view. Squinting, Skylar traced a line from the tip of Nightcliff's tower. There, against the dim clouds, he saw the black shape of a climber, motionless on the cord. Not vanished, then. Just dead.
Loss of power? He thought.
It shouldn't be possible. Something about friction with the atmosphere, he remembered. The elevator couldn't help but generate power. In the 5 years since he first came to the city, he'd never seen Darwin's skyline without the awe-inspiring sight of climber vehicles gliding their way along the cord, taking fresh air and water up to the orbitals, or bringing food back down.
Melville!
Came the garbled voice again.
Last warning!
Skylar absently tapped the transmit button.
Nightcliff, this is the Melville. Don't fire. We're holding position.
We've just heard The Darwin Elevator by Jason Ho. The Magicians is Lev Grossman's original coming-of-age novel about a young man practicing magic in the real world. Quentin Coldwater is brilliant but miserable. A high school senior, he's still secretly preoccupied with a series of fantasy novels he read as a child, set in the magical land called Fillory. After graduation, he's unexpectedly admitted to a very secret, exclusive college of magic in upstate New York. There, he receives a rigorous education in the craft of modern sorcery. But magic doesn't bring Quentin the happiness and adventure he dreamed it would. He and his friends make a stunning discovery. Fillory is real. But the land of Quentin's fantasies turn out to be darker and more dangerous than he could have imagined. Mark Bramall performs an utterly original tale where good and evil aren't black and white, love and sex aren't simple or innocent, and power comes at a terrible price.
Quentin did a magic trick. Nobody noticed. They picked their way along the cold, uneven sidewalk together, James, Julia, and Quentin. James and Julia held hands. That's how things were now. The sidewalk wasn't quite wide enough, so Quentin trailed after them like a sulky child. He would rather have been alone with Julia, or just alone, period, but you couldn't have everything, or at least the available evidence pointed overwhelmingly to that conclusion. Okay, James said over his shoulder. Q, let's talk strategy. James seemed to have a sixth sense for when Quentin was starting to feel sorry for himself. Quentin's interview was in 7 minutes. James was right after him. Nice firm handshake, lots of eye contact. Then, when he's feeling comfortable, you hit him with a chair and I'll break his password and email Princeton. Just be yourself, Q, Julia said. Her dark hair was pulled back in a wavy bunch. Somehow it made it worse that she was always so nice to him. How is that different from what I said? Quentin did the magic trick again. It was a very small trick, a basic one-handed sleight with a nickel.
That was The Magicians by Lev Grossman. Readers, let's share in the success of one of the Book Report's early guests. We spoke with Thurinda Jones on February 19th, 2011, when she was just out with First Grave on the Right, book one in the rollickin' Charlie Davidson Grim Reaper series. Dorinda's been on quite a roll, and today we'll preview her fifth installment in the series, Fifth Grave Past the Light.
Now, should you be unfamiliar with her, Charlie Davidson isn't your everyday run-of-the-mill Grim Reaper. Nope. She's more of a paranormal, private-eye Grim Reaper extraordinaire. However, she always gets sidetracked when the sexy, sultry son of Satan, Reyes Farrow, shows up. To further complicate matters, Reyes is her main suspect in an arson case. Charlie has vowed to stay away from him until she can find out the truth. But then, dead women start appearing in her apartment, one after another. When it becomes apparent her own sister Gemma may be the serial killer's next target, Charlie has no choice but to ask Reyes for help. Arsonist or not, he's the one man alive who can protect Gemma. But he wants something in return. Charlie. All of her body and soul. Lorelei King performs the work.
Unfortunately, my forced smile only encouraged Dead Guy.
You are. You're like the sun reflecting off the chrome bumper of a 57 Chevy.
He splayed his fingers in the air to demonstrate, and my heart was gone. Damn it. He was like all those lost puppies I tried to save as a child to no avail because I had an evil stepmother who believed all stray dogs were rabid and would try to rip out her jugular, a fact that had nothing to do with my desire to bring them into the house.
Yeah, I said under my breath, doing my best ventriloquist impersonation. Thanks.
I'm Duff, he said.
I'm Charlie.
I kept my hands wrapped around my drink lest he decide we needed to shake. Not many things look stranger to the living world than a grown woman shaking air. You know those kids with invisible friends? Well, I was one of those. Only I wasn't a kid, and my friends weren't invisible. Not to me, anyway. And I could see them because I'd been born the Grim Reaper, which was not as bad as it sounded. I was basically a portal to heaven, and whenever someone was stuck on Earth, having chosen not to cross over immediately after death, they could cross to the other side through me. I was like a giant bug light, only what I lured was already dead. I pulled at my extra tight sweater. Is it just me or is it really warm in here? His baby blues shot toward the kitchen again.
Hot is more like it. So I couldn't help but notice you tried to buy that guy over there a drink.
I let my fake smile go, freed it like a captured bird. If it came back to me, it would be mine. If not, it never was. And?
You're barking up the wrong tree with that one.
Surprised, I put my drink down, the one I bought myself, and leaned in a little closer. He's gay?
Duff snorted. No, but he's been in here a lot lately. He likes his women a little looser.
Dude, how much sluttier can I get? I indicated my attire with a sweep of my hand.
No, I mean, well, you're a little...
He let his gaze travel the length of me.
Too tight.
I gasped. I look anal? He drew in a deep breath and tried again.
He only hits on women who are more substantial than you.
Oh, that wasn't offensive at all. I have depth. I've read Proust. No, wait, that was Pooh. Winnie the Pooh. My bad. He shifted his non-existent weight, cleared his throat, and tried again.
More... voluptuous.
I have curves, I said through a clenched jaw. Have you seen my...
Heavier, he blurted out.
I weigh... Oh, you mean he likes bigger women.
Exactly. While I, on the other hand...
Duff's words faded into the background like elevator music. So Marv liked big women. A new plan formed in the darkest, most corrupt corners of Barbara. My brain. Cookie, otherwise known as my receptionist during regular business hours and my best friend 24/7, was perfect. She was large and in charge. Or, well, large and kind of bossy. I picked up my cell phone and called her.
This better be good, she said.
It is. I need your assistance. I'm watching the first season of Prison Break. Cookie, you're my assistant. I need assistance with a case. You know, those things we take on to make money.
That was Fifth Grave Past the Light by Dorinda Jones. Joe Walton's, among others, is the compelling story of a young woman struggling to escape a troubled childhood and a spellbinding tale of escape from ancient enchantment. Raised by a half-mad mother who dabbled in magic, Morwenna Phillips found refuge in two worlds. As a child growing up in Wales, she played among the spirits who made their homes in industrial ruins. But her mind found freedom and promise in the science fiction novels that were her closest companions. Then her mother tried to bend the spirits to dark ends, and Maury was faced to confront her in a magical battle that left her crippled and her twin sister dead. Fleeing to her father, whom she barely knew, Maury was sent to boarding school in England, a place all but devoid of true magic. There, outcast and alone, she tempted fate by doing magic herself in an attempt to find a circle of like-minded friends. But her magic also drew the attention of her mother, bringing about a reckoning that could no longer be put off. Catherine Kellgren narrates.
The Furnacite factory in Abercumboy killed all the trees for 2 miles around. We'd measured it on the myelometer. It looked like something from the depths of hell, black and looming with chimneys of flame, reflected in a dark pool that killed any bird or animal that drank from it. The smell was beyond description. We always wound up the car windows as tight when we had to pass it, and tried to hold our breath, but Grandpa said nobody could hold their breath that long, and he was right. There was sulphur in that smell, which was a hell chemical, as everyone knew, and other, worse things, hot, unnameable metals and rotten eggs. My sister and I called it Mordor, and we'd never been there on our own before. We were 10 years old. Even so, big as we were, as soon as we got off the bus and started looking at it, we started holding hands. It was dusk, and as we approached, the factory loomed blacker and more terrible than ever. 6 of the chimneys were alight, 4 belched out noxious smokes. "Surely it is a device of the enemy," I murmured. Moore didn't want to play. "Do you really think this will work?" "The fairies were sure of it," I said as reassuringly as possible. "I know, but sometimes I don't know how much they understand about the real world." "Their world is real," I protested, "just in a different way, at a different angle." "Yes." She was still staring at the Furnacite, which was getting bigger and scarier as we approached. "But I don't know how much they understand about the angle of the everyday world. And this is definitely in that world. The trees are dead. There isn't a fairy for miles." "That's why we're here," I said. We came to the wire, 3 straggly strands, only the top one barbed. A sign on it read, "No unauthorized admittance. Beware guard dogs." The gate was far around the other side, out of sight. "Are there dogs?" she asked. Moore was afraid of dogs, and dogs knew it. Perfectly nice dogs who would play with me would rouse their hackles at her. My mother said it was a method people could use to tell us apart. It would have worked, too, but typically of her, it was both terrifyingly evil and just a little crazily impractical. "No," I said. "How do you know?" "It would ruin everything if we go back now, after having gone to all this trouble and come this far. Besides, it's a quest, and you can't give up on a quest because you're afraid of dogs. I don't know what the fairies would say. Think of all the things people on quests have to put up with." I knew this wasn't working. I squinted forward into the deepening dusk as I spoke. Her grip on my hand had tightened. "Besides, dogs are animals. Even trained guard dogs would try to drink the water and then they'd die. If there really were dogs, there would be at least a few dog bodies at the side of the pool, and I don't see any. They're bluffing."
That was a sampling of Among Others by Joe Walton. In Gregory Maguire's 3rd volume of The Wicked Years, we return to Oz, seen now through the eyes of the Cowardly Lion. while civil war looms in Oz, an oracle named Yackel prepares for death. Before her final hour, a figure known as Brrr, the Cowardly Lion, arrives searching for information about Elphaba Throp, the Wicked Witch of the West. Abandoned as a cub, his path from infancy is no yellow brick road. In the wake of laws that oppress talking animals, he avoids a jail sentence by agreeing to serve as a lackey to the warmongering Emperor of Oz. A Lion Among Men chronicles a battle of wits hastened by the Emerald City's approaching armies. Can those tarnished by infamy escape to claim their own histories? To live honorably within their own skins before they're skinned alive? John McDonough performs the book.
Yackel reached for something to throw, and all she could find was her other hand, which wouldn't detach. She's doing sign language, the poor deluded dovelet. Clinging to life, so whatever for. Perhaps it isn't her time. It is, said Yackel. It is, I keep telling you. Won't you fiends let me die? I want to go to hell in a handbasket. Put me out of my misery and into the afterlife where I can do some real damage, damn it. She's not herself, said someone. She was never reliably herself, to hear tell, said another. The bedsheets caught fire spontaneously. Yackel found she was rather enjoying this, but it helped neither her reputation nor her rescue that the only liquid nearby with which to douse the flames was cognac. Still, Yackel was not to be dissuaded. "Isn't there a superior in the house?" she asked. "Someone who can lay down the law?" "The Superior Mont died a decade ago," they replied. "We work by consensus now. We've noted your request to be interred alive. We'll put it on the agenda and take it up next week at council." "She'll burn the house down, and us with it," muttered a novice sometime later. Yackel could tell that the innocent speaker was talking to herself to stoke her courage. "Come here, my ducky," said Yackel, grasping. "I smell a little peppermint girl nearby, and no garlicky matron hovering. Are you the sentry? On our own, are we? Come, sit nearer. Surely there is still a sister apothecary in residence, with her cabinets of nostrums and beckhams, tonics and tablets. She must possess a sealed jar. It would be dark blue glass, about yay high, pasted over with a label picturing three sets of crossed tibias. Couldn't you find this and pour me out a fatal little decoction?" "Not a spoonful of it. I ain't the grace to do it," said Peppermint Girl. "Let go of me, you harpy. Let go, or I'll bite you." Out of charity to the young, Yackel let go. It would do the poor girl no good to take a bite out of old Yackel. The antidote ain't been invented yet, and so on. Hours and days pass at elastic rhythms for the blind. Whether the pattern of her naps and wakings followed the ordinary interruptions of daylight by nighttime, Yackel couldn't tell. But someone she recognized as Broccoli Breath eventually informed her that the sorority had decided to bow to Yackel's final wish. They would install her in the crypt among the remains of women long dead. She could approach bodily corruption at whatever speed appealed to her. 3 candles, and as to nourishment, red or white. "A beaker of gasoline and a match as a chaser," said Yackel. But she was indulging in a joke. She was that pleased.
We've just heard A Lion Among Men by Gregory Maguire. Readers, fairy tales for grown-ups are often an enchanting pastiche of love, loss, revenge, and redemption. You have to love them. For more classic fare, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for titles in the news. Thanks for joining us today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.